Jackson never knew his father, which puts him in an interesting presidential category. Presidents tend to either have intense, very strong fathers in their lives, or none at all. If you have raised or are raising normal children, they have no hope of becoming president of the United States. That's it.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, Newsweek editor John Meacham reads from his new biography of Andrew Jackson. The nation's seventh president was the first who really pulled himself up by his bootstraps. In American Lion, Meacham illustrates how a child orphaned by the American War of Independence grew up to be a lawyer, war hero, planter, and politician. John Meacham also wrote a biography about the friendship between Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The Houston Chronicle calls his new book the most readable single-volume biography of Jackson ever written. John Meacham's reading of American Lion was recorded in January 2009 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Jackson, an evening with Andrew Jackson would not be undertaken lightly. This is not an uncomplicated man in many, many ways. When James Parton went to write his great 19th century biography, three volumes of Jackson, he went to interview people he'd grown up with Jackson there in that little pocket of North and South Carolina. And one of the neighborhood boys said, well, we would wrestle, and you'd throw Andy once, and you'd throw him twice, and you'd throw him three times, but he'd never stay throwed. And Jackson never stayed throwed. It is an image that stands the test of time. His sins, which are enormous and glaring, are also the nation's sins, because our sins are enormous and glaring. And we have to take him, I believe, all in all. And there's not a whole lot of point in being retrospectively self-righteous. Arthur Schlesinger used to say that self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap. And I think that's a very good point. Jackson was a key figure in the twin tragedies of American life, slavery and ultimately its legacy, and the removal of Native Americans from east of the Mississippi to west of the Mississippi. But before we are too quick to dismiss, condemn, and move on, I think we should at least stay with the example for a bit to learn from it before we move on. Because unquestionably, as we sit here on this rainy night, there are enormous sins unfolding that I suspect. I have three children, 6, 4, and 10 months. That's one of the reasons I travel a lot. I am sure there will be a moment they will say to me, what was it you didn't get about health care being a human right when you were sick in the United States? What didn't you all understand that perhaps a Marshall Plan for HIV/AIDS would have been a good idea? And so on and so on. One generation's acknowledged good is the next generation's clear evil. And so since history is a story, God willing, of progress, learning from the mistakes of the past, but using that not to feel superior, but to apply that lesson and that wisdom, however easily gained, when we look back and make the hard choices in real time, I think is more useful. And so spending time with Jackson, which is intrinsically fun, let's be clear, this is a man who tried to assault his own assassin, who carried two bullets around with him most of his life, who believed deeply in the role of the president as the interpreter and enactor of the people's will. Like Franklin Roosevelt, I believe it was Richard Hofstadter who said that FDR's philosophy of the presidency was himself in it. And Jackson had a very similar view. That's a widely shared presidential philosophy. It could be very interesting to see what of these awful powers that Bush and Cheney accrued. Let's see what gets given back in about 20 days. Be mighty interested to see that. The warranties have not run out, and so he may not bring them back. He was, I think, our first modern president. He understood power and understood people in a way that most of his direct competitors on the political scene did not. Now, one of the things you have to be careful about when you spend 4 or 5 years with someone like Jackson is you don't take on their hatreds and their jealousies and that sort of thing, because that's a little, you don't want to identify too much. I will say this. Henry Clay presented with every opportunity at every moment when he could make a political decision involving Andrew Jackson, Henry Clay made the wrong one. It was a remarkable streak. He was the Joe DiMaggio of political misjudgments when it comes to Jackson. Like John Quincy Adams, Clay and John C. Calhoun to some extent, in what I hope will be one of the legacies of the Bush years, misunderestimated Andrew Jackson at every turn. And he did it, I think the reason the more professional, more polished politicians did is they just couldn't quite believe that this fella who'd had no education, who talked, you know, he's pronounced the word Blair, who had come great fear that he was going to be a military chieftain, that he was one step away from being a military despot. They couldn't quite think that this man could come to dominate the Washington of the 1820s and 30s, which even then, with due respect to you all, was rather self-absorbed and self-regarding. Washington has never had much of an identity crisis, and no self-esteem issues, despite external facts. But the critical thing, it seems to me, about Jackson's personality was he managed to turn his vices into his virtues. And Lord, if we could all do that, wouldn't it be wonderful? He was seen as a hothead, so when it served his purposes, he would be a hothead. In one of the great stories from the Bank War, a delegation came to him to make the case against what he was doing, and he thundered and spat and spewed and pounded on the desk, and they scurried out. And the moment the door shut, Jackson turned to one of his aides and said, "Didn't I manage them well?" Perfectly done, theatrically. He also was seen, since he was seen as a crazy man, during the great nullification crisis, a phrase that doesn't often set the heart to a flutter, but a very important moment in our history, he threatened to lead the troops into South Carolina himself. He dispatched warships. He sent Winfield Scott. He threatened to hang the first nullifier he could put his hands on. And yet, all the while, he's thundering in public. He's sitting up late into the night, writing letters to his man on the ground, Joel Poinsett, saying, "Whatever you do, don't make the first move. Make sure they are in the wrong. Make sure the radicals go first." He, at the same time, his administration put into play the bill that ultimately resolved the crisis. He was a very sophisticated political player. Sophisticated is not a word that often finds itself attached to Jackson. But I think the evidence of his administration, the evidence of his rise from, we'll talk about this in one second, from a childhood that I sometimes think of as if Charles Dickens had written Deliverance. I mean, that's Andrew Jackson's childhood. It's about as bleak as it can get. And that's from my part of the world, so I can say that. He rose from basically nowhere to defeat, ultimately, the son of another president, and to become the only president who actually has an age named for him. We don't have really an age of Lincoln. We don't have an age of Washington. We do have an age of Jackson. So how did that happen? Let's go back to the Dickens and Deliverance for a second. Jackson never knew his father, which puts him in an interesting presidential category. Presidents tend to either have intense, very strong fathers in their lives or none at all. If you have raised or are raising normal children, they have no hope of becoming president of the United States. That's it. They'll do well, they'll be healthy, and that's great, but they will not be staying at the Hay Adams behind concrete barriers. So give it up. Adams, Kennedy, Bush, McCain, strong fathers. Jackson, Ford, Clinton, Obama, no father at all. Jackson's father died before he was born. His pallbearers lost the casket on the way to the funeral because there was a snowstorm in the South, and we're not used to that sort of thing. And that required a certain amount of lubrication to make sure you could. We didn't have North Face or anything, so we had to drink to stay warm, and that got a little out of hand. But he grew up without daddy. Then his mother and his brothers died in the Revolution. So he's 14 years old. He's been hit over the head with a saber by a British officer for refusing to polish the British officer's boots, leaving a scar the length and width of a man's finger in his head. Francis Preston Blair later put it in the scar. During one of the great crises over presidential power, people were accusing him of betraying the promise of the Revolution by grabbing various bits of executive power. And he said, "I bear upon my person the memorials of the struggle for our liberties," and said, "Put your finger in." Even Lyndon Johnson, I don't think, ever asked anyone to touch the scar. So there's a certain regional earthiness to our presidents that we send up here. And y'all seem to send back really quick. He was standing there at 14. His mother had died in Charleston, taking care of other boys. She'd been nursing revolutionary soldiers. There was terrible outbreaks of disease. Also remember, the Civil War and the Revolutionary War in the South was a civil war, even more so than elsewhere. We tend to think of the Revolution as Saratoga, the Delaware, Valley Forge, all very sort of northern-centric. In South Carolina, Georgia, these were bloody battles, hand-to-hand, neighborhood to neighborhood. And Jackson grew up surrounded by this chaos and absolutely devoted to the idea of the Revolution, that the Whig cause, the last time he'd ever be called a Whig, that he would become part of this new country. And I use the language I'm about to use quite carefully. I am, as Barbara alluded, I've written about religion. I am an Episcopalian. There are six of us left. some debate about whether we're Christian, but we're working on that. And not sure which way, but Jackson believed that his family's blood had consecrated the Union, had made it sacred, had set it apart. I firmly believe this. Now, I am a news magazine editor, so I practice psychiatry without a license every week. And yet, I think the evidence is strong. He referred to the country as one great family. When it came time, 40 years later, for him to stand up to John C. Calhoun and the South Carolina radicals, I could make a pretty good case that a more natural, ideological, political place for Jackson to have landed was with the nullifiers. He called himself a Jeffersonian of the old school, Jeffersonian Republican of the old school. Van Buren had thought of the coalition he helped build as an alliance between the planters of the South and the plain Republicans of the North. Jackson was not a great, great fan of centralized power and centralized institutions, again, unless he was wielding that power. I think the thing, far beyond his anger at Calhoun, he later said his only regret in public life was not having shot Calhoun and hung Clay. There's an exit interview for you. Can you see that on the crawl? Outgoing president, colon. He believed the Union was sacred, because if the Union fell apart, then his family's destruction would have been in vain. And I believe this as strongly as I believe anything that we can infer about Jackson, both from the documents, from the passion he brought to the proclamation of the 10th of December, 1832, which was the great South Carolina proclamation. Jackson wrote far more of his state papers than he's given credit for. Often the first draft or two is in his hand. He was writing the first draft of the proclamation in his office, which is now the Lincoln bedroom, and was writing it so rapidly that the paper was falling off the desk and the ink was glistening. And it was being brought up and packaged together and taken across to Decatur House for Edward Livingston to polish it up. But it's a remarkable document, and one that gets the the poetry, I think, of the Union in a way that Calhoun and the Southerners never really got. They got the prose of it. I could argue again, without too much trouble, that nullification was not way outside the mainstream of a natural implication of a constitutional thought. But with Daniel Webster in 1830 and with Jackson in 1832, the poetry of Union managed to trump the prose. And I'm just going to find this here. It was something he passionately believed in. And without it, and I think without the personal experience, he would not have done what he did in 1832-33, which is what gave us 30 more years for the country to form what Lincoln called the mystic chords of memory. It was a document that, though I cannot find it, Abraham Lincoln was able to. Given the choice, I'd go with Lincoln. Getting the goddamn thing. Sorry. When in doubt, go to the index. When Lincoln was writing, I'll tell this story while I do this. Let's see if I can multitask. When Lincoln was writing his inaugural in 1860-61, he was being besieged by office seekers. Some things never change. And went to the room above his brother-in-law's store in Springfield, Yates and Smith, I think was the name of the store, and sent for four documents. He sent for the Constitution, Webster's second reply to Hayne, Henry Clay's speech on the Compromise of 1850, and Andrew Jackson's proclamation to the people of South Carolina of December 10th, 1832. In the first draft of it, he said, "I call upon you in the language of a father to retrace your steps." Again, another piece of evidence, I think, of the familial metaphor. In his farewell address, he talks about how he has loved the country with the affection of a son. Again, at critical moments, under stress, he went back to that familial imagery. I want to talk a little bit about his education. It will take very little time. He was not at all formally educated, very little. He was better read, however, than almost any of his opponents gave him credit for. And this is a very important point because, again, of the misunderestimation. It's my contention that the most important texts in his head were biblical and Presbyterian. Now, I don't know if there are any Presbyterians here, but in the 18th century, Presbyterians went to church longer than Jesus spent on the cross every Sunday by about a factor of two. There were 5 to 6 hours of oral intake that you would have to, if you were sitting in a pew in a meeting house, you'd be catechized, you would hear the biblical stories, you'd hear sermons. Under stress, and that's the place where Jackson spent the most time, most concentrated time, I think, in his whole life as a boy. Under stress later in his life, he would revert to scriptural imagery. So Henry Clay was not simply a scoundrel. He was the Judas of the West, and his end would be the same. Once Jackson was so angry about something that he talked about how David had grieved over the death of his son Jonathan. Don't know how many of you all know your Bible really well, but Jonathan was not his son. I think it was an emotional thing as opposed to just missing it altogether. He was not a particularly religious man until his health really began to fail, as tends to happen. And I think his legacy to us on church and state is very important because he valued the role of religious people in politics. But he was very skeptical of ministers and organized religion playing too big a role. He did not like any intermediary institution standing between him and the people. He saw it in classic Republican, lowercase r, terms, that intermediary institutions were corrupting, literally bad for the health of the body politic. That included the Bank of the United States, the Electoral College, for the abolition of which he called for in 1829, which would have helped another Democratic nominee from Tennessee. I don't know what it is about Democratic nominees from my state. People tend to win in the country and then lose when they get up here, which is what happened in 1824 to Jackson. The bank, the Electoral College, ministers. He wanted to keep as open a channel as possible between the will of the people and the president. And one could argue that's rather egotistical and rather overly ambitious. But because of the lack of the father and because he was always trying to find situations and worlds in which he would be in authority, in control, and be able to rapidly defend his honor from any sort of attack, he was understandably always a general more than a legislator. And he believed in authority. He believed that his advisors should give their best advice, but that he would make the decision. Now, I want to say this next bit very slowly because it's been a while since we've had this, and it may take a little bit for y'all to fully appreciate it. The seventh president of the United States insisted on being held responsible for everything he did and that happened when he was president of the United States. I can say that again more slowly if you want. One of his favorite phrases was, "I take the responsibility. I take the responsibility." He advised people to make a decision, think it out, hear all points of view, but when you decide, move quickly and take the responsibility. And so he was willing, and to his credit, he was willing to enjoy the privileges of authority, but he was also willing to take the responsibility. And there's an intellectual and emotional consistency there and continuity that I think we should credit. It is not to say that every president who came after him was a great president or a powerful one, but his best successors had the means, because of Jackson, to do things on the part of the people that they did not have, would not have had without him. Lincoln, we've talked about. Theodore Roosevelt explicitly said that Jackson was the greatest American save for Washington and Lincoln, and that he had been president in the Lincoln-Jackson school, not the Buchanan school, not a high bar there. FDR, as we were talking about, FDR, I think it's a little bit more than he loved Jackson. I think he had a man crush on Jackson. FDR at that point was trying to find a dueling icon to the Republicans, Lincoln. And so the Jefferson Memorial was being built, dedicated in 1943. But Jackson was even more of an emotional favorite for FDR because FDR saw himself as a latter-day Jackson taking on the bank and concentrated wealth and the malefactors of great wealth, as he put it. In 1937, you know, the inaugural stand on Pennsylvania Avenue was an exact replica of the Hermitage there. And so it was a very tactile, very real thing to FDR. And the president, I would argue, who is most like Jackson in his successive years is Harry Truman. Self-educated man, devoted, underestimated, strong, temperamental, may we say. The only distinction there is Jackson would have punched the music critic in the nose. He would not simply have threatened it. And punching in the nose would have been a minor reaction for Jackson. Truman said that as president, Jackson looked after the little fella who had no pull, and that's what a president is supposed to do. Truman also, however, was quite articulate on Jackson's sins, with Indian removal and with slavery, and understood that we can have inspiring historical examples, but we can also have cautionary ones, often in the same person. And I don't know about you all, but I sometimes think I'm capable of great good and great evil, often within the same 10-minute span. Presidents are no different. Leaders are no different. The country, in a way, is no different than that. I want to leave you with this and then hear any questions you all have. When Jackson died, George Bancroft, the great historian, statesman, gave a wonderful eulogy in which Bancroft talks about the showdown in 1832-33 with Calhoun, with South Carolina. And here's what Bancroft said of Jackson. "The moral of the great events of those days with South Carolina is this, that the people can discern right and will make their way to a knowledge of right, that the whole human mind, and therefore with it the mind of the nation, has a continuous, ever-improving existence, that the appeal from the unjust legislation of today must be made quietly, earnestly, perseveringly, to the more enlightened collective reason of tomorrow, that submission is due to the popular will, in the confidence that the people, when in error, will amend their doings, that in a popular government, injustice is neither to be established by force nor to be resisted by force. In a word, that the union, which is constituted by consent, must be preserved by love." Wise words, I think, for all of us. Thank you all very much.
Explain why he was willing to do what he did with the Indians. I've never understood why he was willing to do the kick them out of Georgia, send them on the Trail of Tears. What's the psychological or whatever reason for that?
There are three factors at work, I think. One is national security, in his view, immediately raises the question, whose nation? He believed that the Indian tribes were potential, real and potential allies for European adventurers and other foreign forces that might try to disrupt the country. That had been his experience to some extent in 1812 and to some extent in his Indian wars through the ensuing decade. That's one. The second is a kind of, I find, ultimately reprehensible paternalism, because he believed to some extent that he was the great father, the great white father of the Indians. And he said, his papers on this are quite eloquent, "I speak to you as your great father. You must move from the path of the rapacious white man in order to preserve your way of life, and I will take care of you beyond the Mississippi." But he didn't. And you can't credit a great, strong, powerful leader who would do anything for the common man as long as they were white men. If Jackson had wanted to manage the Trail of Tears in a way that might have made it not the Trail of Tears, but a removal process, he had such a force of will, even though it happened after he was out of the White House. He spent most of his time writing letters to his successors telling them what he thought they should do. He could have figured out a way to do this. And so I think that was a huge part of it. The other thing is a simple motive of greed, frankly, of which he was the embodiment. Whites, particularly white planters, wanted that land. That's part of the world I come from. It was good land. They found gold on it. Boy, talk about the end of it. That was that, up in Dahlonega, Georgia. One of perhaps the most tragic part of this is the Cherokee story, because the Cherokees had done everything the white man had asked them to do, to the point of having plantations and owning slaves. I mean, you want to become white? There you go. They had built a culture. They had a newspaper. Sequoia had done something that has almost never happened in human experience, created a language, an alphabet. So the experience of the Cherokees is it's hard to say which is the worst, but it is particularly poignant. He did win the battle in the House. This was voted on by Congress in 1830. It was very close. Jeremiah Evarts, who was sort of the William Lloyd Garrison of the Indian removal question, but who died young, is almost entirely lost to history, I think partly because he lost and Garrison won. There was a strong moral case to be made for the Indians, but it was ultimately not successful in the congressional vote. And once it happened, once the vote happened, it basically disappeared from the legislative agenda. It became a matter for the War Department, and ultimately Jackson pushed forward. And nobody really tried to stop him. And this is an unrelentingly grim story. From 1622 at least, which is when the first recorded massacre between whites and Native Americans was, until then, and even beyond, far beyond. But those were the three things in his mind. He wanted the land. He thought the country would be safe. And in a misguided way, he thought ultimately this would secure Indian culture.
How did he campaign, especially the first time? Because we know how Harry Truman did it. He could make a direct connection with people on radio and in movies, and FDR the same.
Right.
But not available to Jackson.
No, it was very, very different. And though the origins of our modern system, hickory clubs, barbecues, torchlight parades, all that comes from the Jackson campaigns, he still had that kind of faux Cincinnatus requirement. The culture demanded that he not make huge personal appearances. That begins to break down in 1832. And again, sorry to keep kicking him, Henry Clay. Clay says, I cannot imagine, because Jackson was stopping off occasionally, dropping off, and might occasionally encounter a large barbecue, just happenstance. I do that a lot. Mm-hmm. On the way out, I may just run into a barbecue. Clay turns down invitations to make personal appearances, saying it's undignified. And Jackson was beginning to push things a lot closer to what we know. What people knew about him was what they read, a blow for the print media. John Eaton, whom we've talked about, who was one of the reasons he was so close to Jackson, is he had written something called The Letters of Wyoming, which was the case for Jackson, and had written a biography of Jackson. And so it was a very limited kind of campaigning. But by the time Amos Kendall and others had created hickory clubs and that sort of thing, you ended up building the modern Democratic Party on pulled pork of the real kind, not just the other.
Do you think, to any extent, Jackson has been a model for President-elect Obama? And will he be? And what will be the clues that there's an impact in the next year, 2 years down the road, that there's a Jacksonian influence on Mr. Obama?
I think it's a stylistic one, which seems odd because they seem about as different as you could be. But one of the things Jackson perfected with Amos Kendall and Francis Preston Blair was the idea of a constant channel of political communication from the president to his supporters. Jackson saw that people wanted to be engaged in politics, not just on a quadrennial basis, but all the time. And he made himself – Jackson was one of the first great American celebrities. I mean, he kept a portrait painter in the White House. It's like having David Hume Kennerly there, having a videographer. He believed that his image should be prevalent, should be that through the Washington Globe ultimately – that his word should be, Jackson would have adored YouTube. He would have done that, would have loved the internet. Basically founding your own newspaper. I mean, when he founded his own paper in the late autumn of 1830, he basically was becoming kind of the Roger Ailes of his own administration. You know what I mean? It was as if Bush had created Fox. Or to be fair, if Obama had created NPR, let's be honest. He suddenly had his own way of communicating. And it's clear that Obama understands that people want to be part of an ongoing, unfolding narrative. Remember, Obama thinks of himself, I think, as a writer first and a lawyer second, if you ask him. We have something in the Newsweek book, which is coming out soon, which was based on our election project the day after the election, where we got an audio tape of Obama analyzing his own debate performances during the primaries, and they hadn't been going well. And he says, well, you know, I can do this a little bit better because I can stand outside myself and see what's going on. That's why I'm a pretty good writer. He understands narrative clearly. And the emails, the you know, signing him Barack, the radio message that's now on YouTube, so I guess we should stop calling it a radio message, I think are all Jacksonian tools of modern political communications. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.